You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks, just a quick announcement. We're in the midst of a very important fundraising drive to come up with all of our production costs for 2016. If you like Kick-Ass Politics and you value what I'm doing here, then I hope you'll go to GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics and donate what you can. It's vital that we fund our production budget for the coming year so I can focus my energies on the content side of Kick-Ass Politics and keep producing new episodes for you every week. So be a part of what I'm creating here. Just go to GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics or hit the donate button on our webpage at KickAssPolitics.com. Thanks in advance, folks, and now enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. Anytime you see a magazine cover featuring a famous politician or a well-known head of state, it was probably shot by my guest today, photographer Platon. Over the years, he's photographed countless rock stars, athletes, and movie stars, but he's best known for his iconic images of powerful world leaders. He's captured every living U.S. president from Jimmy Carter straight up to Barack Obama, and he's photographed well over 100 world leaders, including Tony Blair, Ban Ki-moon, Benjamin Netanyahu, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Silvio Berlusconi, Muammar Gaddafi, Christine Lagarde, Philippe Calderon, Dmitry Medvedev, Hugo Chavez, Robert Mugabe, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and the 2007 Time Magazine Man of the Year cover of Vladimir Putin, for which he won the World Press Photo Award. That's to say nothing of Washington power brokers like Henry Kissinger, John McCain, Nancy Pelosi, Ted Kennedy, John Kerry, Robert Gates, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Jesse Jackson, and Supreme Court Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Antonin Scalia, and John Paul Stevens, just to name a few. His work has been featured on 20 Time magazine covers, as well as GQ, Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Vanity Fair, Esquire, New York Times Magazine, Wired, and Texas Monthly. In 2007, he became the permanent staff photographer for The New Yorker magazine, where he's produced a series of large-scale photo essays, including his collaboration with Human Rights Watch, covering Russia's civil society, for which he won a Peabody Award. That led to Platon's founding of his own nonprofit called The People's Portfolio, which aspires to create a visual language to break barriers and enlist public support for human rights around the world. On today's podcast, he'll reveal some of his secrets for getting the most powerful people in the world to let their guard down. He'll talk about photographing Vladimir Putin as the most intimidating experience of his life, and that now infamous cover photo of Bill Clinton for Esquire magazine, plus a whole lot more with legendary photographer Platon coming up in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
When you walk past your local newsstand, you will probably see his work on the cover of magazines from Time and Esquire to Rolling Stone, GQ, Wired, and The New Yorker, where he's been the staff photographer since 2008. Platon, thanks for joining me in the studio.
It's good to be here.
You photographed any number of celebrities, models, musicians, but you've become synonymous with taking portraits of powerful world leaders. How did that become your thing?
I think I've got a healthy disregard for power, and I never thought it would be a sort of important qualification for a specific career. So I don't know. I've always had this feeling that, you know, Martin Luther King described it as the illusion of supremacy.
Huh.
And it's something that really resonated with me when I heard that in a speech one time that he made. It's this idea that, you know, no one really is above anybody else. And as long as you treat people with equal respect, I don't see why I should bow lower for anyone in particular than anyone else. I mean, my job is to try and perhaps readdress the balance in society of how we regard perfection, and to maybe bring down and humanize a little bit the people at the top, and then bring up and celebrate the people at the bottom, and try and remind everyone that, you know, we're all equal.
Well, I want to talk to you about a few photos in particular that you're perhaps most famous for. And we'll make this interactive for the listeners with your permission. I'll post them to our Instagram at KAA Politics and our Facebook account so listeners can scroll through as we talk about these particular pictures. Like I said, only with your permission.
Sure, no problem. Okay. I mean, I'm actually on Instagram now. I just joined. So anyone wants to follow me, I'm trying to build a fascinating platform to
drive change.
How are
you just now getting on Instagram?
I hate technology. I'm notoriously bad with dealing with technology. I still have never sent an email in my life. So there's a problem with it in my mind. It's so liberating. It's such an amazing new revolution we're going through. But it's in danger of robbing us of a certain freedom, ironically. You know, you don't look up anymore. Everyone's looking down at their phone constantly. No one has a moment of reflection. And, you know, something that George Clooney said to me quite recently when I was taking his picture, which was really interesting. He said that, you know, we have more information at our fingertips than ever before, more connectivity than ever before. And yet, in many cases, we seem to know less. And if you want to get the news, you're probably going to go to a source online that's going to confirm what you already believe. So that means we might be in danger of being trapped in our own echo chambers. So, you know, this idea,
especially on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah. So the idea of the shared experience is rapidly diminishing, ironically. That magical place where we are respectfully debating and exchanging different values, different political ideologies, different faith values, different cultures. You know, that's really important to share. You know, you have to be courageous to put your ideas aside and actually listen to another point of view. Firstly, it's respectful to do that. Secondly, you might actually learn something. And I think as an eternal student, perpetual student, my job is always to be the guest in someone's home. And that's how you learn, you know. And so I know what I know, but what I don't know is what you know. And I think that's much more interesting.
I actually tend to watch the news channels that necessarily aren't aligned with my values because I don't want to be in an echo chamber all the time where I just hear the same thing. I want to know what else is going on out there.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, my job is to tear down those echo chambers and to provoke. I mean, I've been taught to be a cultural provocateur. I do believe that it's time more than ever to focus on the things that actually unite us rather than to focus on the things that we think divide us. We all actually have a lot more in common than we ever expected. And yet somehow we choose to ignore all those things. And we're all focusing on the tribal ideologies that separate us. You know, this is what you believe, so you're over there and I'm over here. And I think that's, you know, look at what's going on with the election now. Election years are always, you know, a bit tempestuous, but it should be about different ways to get to the right solution that we all agree on. Problem is, we all seem to disagree on what that right solution is at the end. It should be a universal idea of fairness, justice, truth and righteousness. I mean, that's what we all strive for in society, and we all share that value. And yet we seem to be putting that aside. And I think that's really a tragic situation for an incredible democracy like America.
Yeah. And let's, since you're a provocateur, let's look at some of your provocative photos and talk about them. You know, and like I said, folks, if you want to go on Facebook or Instagram, you can scroll through as we're talking here and look at them yourself, because it's kind of hard to do a visual medium on a podcast. So this first one is of Barack Obama before he was elected president. And then you also have one of him afterwards when he was president. Talk about those shoots.
You know, it was the color image was taken 1 hour after he announced he's running for president. So, you know, it was the beginning of plotting the journey of power. And, you know, it was a time at the beginning of that election campaign where there was all this incredible charisma and great skill in public speaking that he had. And it seemed to fit the bill perfectly for it was like the solution we all hoped would come to America's problems. And you know, I remember saying to him, you know, Mr. Obama, my mom thinks you're fantastic and she hopes you make it to the White House. And I remember he leaned forward and he said, tell your mama I said hi. And it was just a fantastically American moment for me as an Englishman to sort of have that exchange. But the other picture is actually the real Obama. And, you know, I think he's much more cautious than we all expected as a politician. He seems to like to weigh up all the options in the room before he makes his final decision. And in many cases, he's been criticized for that. I remember he was reading a self-help book back in those days, and it was called, to my knowledge, I seem to remember it was called Be Quiet, Be Heard, How to Raise Delicate Issues with an Opponent and Still Find Common Ground, essentially how to compromise. And I think that's kind of interesting that perhaps, I mean, I see things in a simplistic way. I'm certainly not an intellectual, but to me, these are the clues that I discover on my journey. And sometimes they seem to make sense when you look back at recent history.
Well, the next photo is one of his predecessors, one of your most famous or maybe even infamous photos. We have Bill Clinton in full man spread. How did that come about? Did you ask him to pose like that, or was that his idea?
You know, so much has been read into this picture. I don't really know what to say. You know, it was my first president. Some say it should have been my last. I'd never come into contact with that kind of power level before. The magazine wanted me to do a nice dignified headshot. They knew I shoot with this sort of exaggerated sense of perspective.
Use a wide-angle lens,
yeah,
close up a lot.
I mean, for me, it's not a gimmick, you know. It's body language, and it's how I see people. You know, my job is not to create a perfect picture that everyone's pleased with. My job is to give you the feeling of what it's really like to meet someone. I'm interested in the humanity of it, the connection. I'm not interested in the Hollywood perfection that actually is fake. It doesn't exist. So, I shoot from the hip. You know, I shoot sometimes from a low perspective. If you get this feeling of being overwhelmed with someone's charisma or even someone's authority, then that does something to you. And as an artist, my job is to try to make you feel what I feel when I'm in these people's presence. So, you know, I asked him, I did all the dignified headshots that the magazine insisted, but the magazine warned me that for their greatest cover they ever had, I mean, in their 80-year history, it was the first time I think they may have got the president. So it was a big deal for them. And I think that, you know, they said, whatever you do, do not use that wide-angle lens. This is the bloody president, you know, and people just don't do that with the president. So, you know, I when I was with him, I had a moment. I had a moment where I think I became me. And I realized that, you know, all this sort of fake sense of power is all constructed. It's not real. I mean, he's just a person like I'm a person, but he has this extraordinary charisma. And I thought, you know, why should I bend and kneel before power and just perpetuate this idea of formality that we all think is suitable for the presidency, when I had seen him grilled in the most humiliating way by the media for the last year about the Lewinsky scandal? And I thought that was much more disrespectful to the presidency than anything I could do. So for me, it was nothing to do with sex, this picture. It was dubbed the crotch shot.
Yeah. For people who haven't seen it, which is there probably isn't anyone who hasn't seen it, but he's sitting on a stool or a chair and his legs are spread wide apart with his hands on his knees there.
Yeah. I mean, I said to him in that moment, I thought, look, you're never going to be in front of another president ever again. It's fluke. You got this far. So you might as well do the picture you're born to do. So to the horror of my assistants, I put on the wide angle lens and I just wanted to get his charisma. So I said to him, Mr. President, will you show me the love? And there was silence in the room. I mean, all his advisors, their jaws just opened and they were horrified with what is about to happen, I'm sure. And someone, one of his advisors, it may have been his chief of staff, I can't remember, said to him out loud, Mr. President, whatever you do, do not show him the love. You know, with the sort of caveat that you know, yeah, we've had enough love in this administration.
Right.
Well, Clinton got it, though. You know, and I remember him saying, I know what he means. I know what he wants. And so he put his hands on his knees and he gave me the Clinton charisma. It wasn't a picture about sex at all. It was a picture about this man's majestic sense of charisma that is just unstoppable. Irrespective of what your political views are, it's undeniable that this guy connects with people. So when it was published, I had no idea that this would be published on the cover of a magazine. When it was, I mean, look, he was a new generation of president. He was a rock and roll guy. And I was a new generation of photographers. You know, I didn't really grow up admiring this sort of Hollywood 1980s leftover sense of perfection. For me, I wanted the truth. All my favorite movies were gritty. Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Yeah. I shoot from the street. So for me, I wanted to show what it was really about. And I remember Larry King did an hour's show on this, if I remember rightly. And he invited Bob Woodward on one photo. And that's how I first I was watching it live. And I was, you know, shocked as I heard Larry King rant and rave saying, this is disgusting that we show our president in this lurid sexual way. And Bob Woodward, you know, analyzed the picture as well. And he said, it's all about sexuality. The hands are big. The legs are spread. The face is smiling, saying, I got away with it. And the tie is an arrow, he even claimed. You know, all that, all those intellectual guys, they just don't get it. You know, a while later, after this came out, I had so much criticism that I became the guy that demonized the presidency, that did this sort of everyone, it turned into a sex picture. And I remember walking home from Harlem one day and I passed an old barber shop. And I felt so depressed that this was my chance to make it in America and I had screwed it up. And I passed this barbershop and in the window they had three pictures on the wall. One was JFK from the 60s. One was Martin Luther King. And the third one, they had just cut out my picture of Clinton and put it in the frame. And then I realized something really powerful. It came to me that I'm not doing this for the intellectuals. I'm not doing it for the power system. I'm not doing it to win awards. I don't give a damn about all that. What I'm doing it for is to give the people an icon to provoke respectful debate. And this is an incredible country. We have this thing called democracy, and we need to exercise it. And this picture summed up the times. In America, we had a balanced budget. There was employment figures. So, I mean, our economy was in great shape back then. It was all about the good old days when all we had to worry about was whether our president, you know, was up to no good in the Oval Office.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I'll talk more with Platon about Vladimir Putin, his experience photographing the Egyptian Revolution, and how it inspired him to start his own nonprofit that uses photography to fight human rights abuse. When we come back in just a moment. Folks, do you like to read but you don't have the time? Give audiobooks a try. All those times you spend listening to this podcast, you can also be listening to a great book. You can play it on your drive to work, on a run, in the bathtub, while cooking, or just sitting and enjoying one of those rare stolen moments. And right now, you can download any audiobook you want for free with a special promotion for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free download of any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking to photographer Platon. As we were talking about this whole uproar over the Bill Clinton Esquire cover, I was thinking to myself, I'm curious if you think that people confer on your work more intention and artistic manipulation than there really is to your process.
Because you're fairly minimalist. You usually don't bring along a ton of lights. Mm. You're not Annie Leibovitz. No. There aren't a bunch of costume changes and everything.
Well, you know.
And it seems that you're trying to get to, as I understand it, you're trying to get to the real person with the wide-angle lens, trying to get the most authentic version of who they want to be.
My father was a modern architect, and he brought me up with a modern movement. Form follows function. Minimalist. Strip it down to the truth. If a building is made of concrete, don't cover that up. You have to show it's made of concrete. If a table is made of wood, you don't paint it. You should show that it's wood. There's something truthful and beautiful about being authentic. Now, I wasn't good enough at maths and science to become an architect. So I found myself becoming a photographer, but I adopted so many of those ethics. So for me, you know, Annie Leibovitz's process... You know, I admire Annie greatly, by the way, and she has sat for me, so we know each other. And she was a fantastic lady, very respectful and very motherly, actually, to me, because I was the next generation. But, you know, in terms of direction and what I aim to get out of a picture, we couldn't be more different. You know, I grew up sort of reacting against the surface of the 1980s. You know, the fame, the glitz, the glamour. For me, I was the grit, the truth, authentic sense of what it's really like to meet somebody. And that means strip it all away. So all you see is the person, their spirit, their character. That moment is frozen in time. And if you're simplifying it down, it allows the people to really look at it and feel it and not be distracted by a beautiful house in the background or, you know, props and sets. That's all adding surface and gimmicks. Should be no gimmicks.
And I imagine that serves you well when you're dealing with world leaders, because sometimes you have to be in and out and you're working on their schedule.
Yeah.
And one good example is the next photo, which it was on the cover of Time as Time's Person of the Year in 2007. And you won a World Press Photo Award for this photo. Mm. It's of the Time Man of the Year, Vladimir Putin.
Mm.
What was that like?
I mean, you know, by then I had done many world leaders, but that was the first time I really came into a sort of contact with a threatening sense of power. You know, I mean, it's intimidating at the best of times to some extent, but Putin was on another level. And coming out of that shoot, I really felt, all right, I've just been to boot camp. And it was only after that that I could handle other characters like Gaddafi, Mugabe, Ahmadinejad. So it really trained me rather well.
He doesn't like being photographed.
It's the only portrait taken of him, as far as I know.
Really?
He's never sat for another sort of independent photographer, you might say.
Wow.
So it was done in his private dasher. They told me it was going to be in the Kremlin in this dark day in December in Moscow. And I was picked up by a black Kremlin BMW and driven through the streets of Moscow past the Kremlin out into a dark, bleak, gothic forest. So I thought I was going to get whacked by the new KGB, right?
Yeah.
I arrived at this, you know, this imposing building in the forest, covered in snipers on a security wall, you know, and they're all pointing at me. And at gunpoint, I'm led into this building, which is actually very historic because it's where they dissolved the Soviet Union. And I remember, you know, he walks in with all his advisors and translators. And, you know, despite all that, he actually speaks really, really good English. And I said to him, I said to him, look, it's great to be here, Mr. President. Well, I have a question for you as an ordinary person. I said, I'm a massive Beatles fan. Are you? And he said, I really like the Beatles. So I was shocked. And I said, well, who's your favorite Beatle? And he said, Paul. And then I said, well, what's your favorite song? Is it Back in the USSR? And it raised a few eyebrows, I think. But he actually said, no, my favorite song is Yesterday. And he looked up to the ceiling as if he's looking to for a divine inspiration. And then I thought about it. Yesterday, I mean, if you look, read between those lines, I feel that he wants everything to go back in time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So
that says a lot.
So, but joking aside, it was the fact suddenly that we had this connection with popular culture and it allowed me in. And I ended up an inch and a half away from his nose, focusing my camera. I could feel his breath on my hand. I was that close. And that's how I got, I think, what is the truth, that this is the cold face of authority in Russia. And ironically, he likes it and his supporters like it because it shows him as a tough nationalist. But the best thing for me is that his opposition, the human rights movement that I am now part of, they love the picture because it shows everything that's wrong with power and authority in Russia. And it's become their banner, and they use it in flags and demonstrations throughout Russia, driving for change. Now, you know, that's, again, the award for me. It goes back to the people, and it gives them a flag to wave to say, these are the times we live in. And this is either what's right with the times that we fight for or what's wrong with the times that we fight against. And people need sometimes a song, if you look at Dylan, or sometimes people need an image. And images have stopped wars. I mean, it was that image of the napalm little girl that helped end our involvement with the Vietnam War, because people saw something that it's frozen for life and it becomes an icon to drive change. So in many cases, the Putin picture has become one of those strange pictures that it actually it gave people something to really think about.
Yeah, because you had the Time picture, which was on the cover of Time magazine, that's a close-up. And then there was another photo that people kind of called the mafia gangster pose, where he's in a very menacing and sitting in a chair. It's like a three-quarter shot of him there.
Look, you know, look,
he's
clearly
intimidating in that one.
Clearly,
very.
I am not an intellectual, right? And certainly whenever I'm
I wouldn't say
well,
that.
No, but when I'm in the New Yorker offices, for instance, I'm always the dumbest person in the room. but here's the interesting thing, and I do love sparring with the intellectuals, right? And the picture of Putin as a gangster, as you call it, I call it the performance of power. It's this almost the same composition as Clinton.
Now, it is. I've noticed, yeah,
no intellectual has ever said, but it's the same picture. They see the Clinton thing about sex, and then they see the Putin thing, and they refer to it as a power or gangster image. Now, it's the same picture. It's almost the same colors, the same pose. The tie is still an arrow, if that's what you want to think of a tie is. But no one says that Putin is about sex. Yeah. So what that means to me is that you are reading into the picture what you feel in your mind. And it's not necessarily what I see in my mind. What I see is what I experienced on the day. And even though technically it's a very similar picture, the feeling you get from those two guys couldn't be more opposite. One is seduction, charisma, and the other one is cold authority at all costs. And yet it's the same construction.
Yeah, I mean, they really are. I thought about saying that, but I didn't want to accuse you of being redundant. So,
I'm very aware of all my inadequacies, believe me.
You know, the last photo that I want to show you is from the uprising in Egypt and the Arab Spring. You spent some time in Tahrir Square taking photographs, and there's this photo, I'll let you explain this because I think it speaks for itself.
You know, I had to build my platform. I had to earn the right to have this position in the media. But once I'd got there, you know, you have to look at yourself and say, all right, you can't just keep notching up the bedposts with all your victories. At some point, you have to do something with the platform that you built. And I care deeply about human rights and civil rights and what is fair and what is not fair in society. And although I never preach a political point of view or even a moral point of view, by giving you images that are provocative, it empowers society to debate. And only through respectful debate can we come to those good solutions. So I got involved with human rights. I started collaborating with Human Rights Watch. I formed my own foundation called the People's Portfolio. And my job now is to create a new set of cultural heroes, people who are not promoting a fake perfection that intimidates us, like perhaps Hollywood or politics does, but people who actually inspire us with their courage in the face of great challenge. So I went to the middle of Tahrir Square when the Egyptian revolution was in full swing, and I photographed all the ordinary men, women, children, elderly people who came across the board to all fight for something they all had in common, and that's human dignity and freedom. So there was this one kid, his name was Remy, beautiful, handsome guy, and every day he would go to the square and he would play his guitar and sing protest songs. And his message was very beautiful. It was men and women come together, Muslims, Christians come together, elderly people, young people come together because we're all united. And he became known as the singer of the revolution. Now, this became rather threatening, I believe, to the state. So one night, I guess it was the secret police or somebody as part of the state pulled him aside and wanted to intimidate him. They ripped his shirt off and began to taser his back. Now, they had a formal torture policy back in those days, and they will taser you until you scream uncontrollably, and then you're broken, so they stop. But this guy just refused to scream. I mean, he had a strong, wow. He had the constitution of an ox. So his silence meant that there were no breaks. So they kept on going until his back caught fire.
Oh, my God.
And he nearly died. He was rushed to hospital. And 3.5 weeks later, he was released. And instead of going home to rest, he came to the photographer in the middle of the square, which was me. And he arrived on set, and I asked if he would show me his back. He took his shirt off, and they took the bandages off. And I burst into tears because I have never seen flesh hurt in that way up close. And I held his hand and I said, my dear friend, I'm so sorry what happened to you. You know, the marks on your back are awful and nobody should ever hurt another human being in this way. And he said, my dear friend, never feel sorry for me because I wear these marks with great pride. You see, it's evidence I stood for change. And he said, the more they hurt me, the stronger I became. But I've come for your help, he said. I want you to photograph me not as a victim, but as a victor. We did this picture together.
A powerful photo.
And it actually became the poster for the revolution because it gave a lot of people courage to say that this is what happens to us. But if this guy can take it, maybe we can too.
Now, you mentioned your foundation, the People's Portfolio. What's the idea behind it? What do you want people to do? Is it a call to action that's implied with these pictures?
I think the media is in great trouble with disruption online. And I think that, you know, traditional media is really struggling for their readers, their loyal supporters. So I think their budgets are down. Their readership is getting very fluttery. So they're, you know, they don't want to provoke them too much. They certainly don't have the money to invest in big, big stories as they used to. So I got fed up with waiting around to try and persuade my editors to take on a story that I think is important. Conversely, you've got all these NGOs around the world who do amazing work, but they don't know how to do storytelling, mainly. So that's not part of their mission. So there's a big gap between the real stories that are happening. And we as a society are not being informed. So I decided as a communicator, as a storyteller, to use the skills that I have to put them to good use and become the bridge builder. So I raise my own money now. So that makes me completely independent because I now know a lot of wealthy, powerful people. And I collaborate with my friends in the NGO world. They give me the stories, the statistics. I humanize them, bring them to life. So it's no longer a number. It's now a little girl. It could be your little girl. And that's the key. If you see yourself in these stories, then you're moved to do something. But if you don't see yourself in numbers and figures, then it's easier for you to turn away and think this is not relevant to my life. So without pointing fingers, without making you feel guilty, I want you to be inspired by these people's courage because it takes a lot to stand in the face of adversity and keep your dignity. And that's what I'm fascinated by. It's that heroic
moment. It's a great idea.
So it's working, and I'm now giving the stories back to the media for free. So that because they can't afford them anyway.
Yeah.
And it's working. My thing is just get the stories out.
Terrific idea, and it's a great foundation. Before we go, do you have a white whale, someone you're dying to photograph that you've never gotten?
There are so many. You know, the Queen would be nice.
You better hurry up.
I know, and I am on the list, but that's all I know. That's how the palace operates. But there's always the bad guys that I'm always trying to negotiate. You know, I mean, Edward Snowden took me over a year to build trust with his people. It took me a year and a half to win over many heads of state at the UN. So it takes a long time, and your reputation is built on you sort of not taking shortcuts and going for the, you know, instant hit, but to actually persuade people that you mean serious business. You're here not to point fingers, but to just tell the truth. And so it's the negotiation is always ongoing. But the exciting thing is that I never really know what's going to work. And it's a constant mix of mixing with Hollywood's elite, the power elite, and then being in the front line of some very, very severe stories around the world where it's very dangerous. And I'm very privileged to be in that position.
Well, I know that you have to go. You have a speech tonight. Before we go, you know, not to sound like a fanboy, but can I ask, would you take a selfie of me?
How can I take a selfie of you?
Okay.
With you?
A photo with my phone.
I can do that.
Oh, my God. I totally thought that you would say no. I am so insanely honored.
I'll do it. Right. And so you're going to hear how this works on a Platon shoot. Right. Chin up a bit.
Okay.
There you go. Chin down a little bit. That's a little bit Putin. You want to be careful. All right. Got it. Got it in one.
Oh, my God. That was amazing. Okay, folks. A limited edition numbered prints will be on sale for $6,000 a piece on Monday. Limit
and
three per customer.
All the proceeds are going to my foundation. Thank you so much.
I can honestly say this has been the best platonic relationship I've ever had. Platon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Fight the power.
Thanks again to Platon for coming on the show. You can view his work every month in the New Yorker magazine or at platonphoto.com or on his Instagram at Platon. That's Platon. Also, you can donate or find out more about his work to combat human rights abuse by visiting his foundation, The People's Portfolio, at thepeoplesportfolio.org. Don't forget to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes, and please recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends on social media. And if you really want to help us out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics, or go to our website and click on the donate button. You can follow us on Twitter at KA Politics, or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And as always, I welcome your comments and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. On the next podcast, I'll talk with Democrat pollster and Fox News political analyst Doug Schoen about his new book, The Nixon Effect: How Richard Nixon's Presidency Fundamentally Changed American Politics. For a Democrat, he has surprising praise for what he describes as probably the most accomplished and maybe even the most liberal presidency of the past century. And he offers insight into how Nixon permanently drove both parties to their extremes and pioneered tactics that have now become indispensable to modern politics. Coming up in the next episode with Fox News political analyst Doug Schoen. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics.
This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.